Welcome to Backlisted, the podcast that gives new life to old books. Today, you find us in the City of London. It is September 1665, and we are locked in a small tradesman's house in the east of the city. A watchman stands guard at the locked door, and outside, the piteous screams of the afflicted echo through the empty streets. I'm John Mitchinson, the publisher of Unbound, the platform where readers crowdfund the books they really want to read.
And I'm Andy Miller, author of The Year of Reading Dangerously. Joining us today are the writer and backlisted listener, James Hannah.
Hello.
Who has listened to 90 hours of this podcast in a week. No, over the space of several years. Hello, James.
Hello.
James's first novel, The A to Z of You and Me, was published by Doubleday in 2015 and was listed for the Desmond Elliott Prize for Debut Fiction. He's currently at work on a second novel. He has a master's in Samuel Beckett studies from the University of Reading, home of the Beckett International Foundation.
Do you get a sort of fail better diploma? You failed, but you failed.
I failed to fail better, which is double Beckett.
I'm off to Dublin next week, and in a very on-the-nose reading choice, I have selected Murphy.
Oh, now, this is what I've been trying to persuade you to bring onto Backlisted, Murphy. Oh,
very close to my favourite novel. Have you not read it before, Andy?
I've not read it before, and the reason I'm reading it is I'm reading half a dozen of Penelope Fitzgerald's favourite books.
Very good.
That was one of them. Very, very revealingly, Beckett was one of her favourite writers. Wouldn't think that, would you?
I read a great Beckett quote this week from someone on Twitter, so whoever it is, claim it. Beckett was asked, "You don't have any children," and he said, "Luckily for them."
Do you know who tweeted that?
Who was it?
That was me.
There you go.
That was from Beckett Remembering Beckett by James Nolson.
And, brilliant.
Nobody's read that book because, you know, it's just a niche Beckett book. Sorry, James.
Beckett was my absolute thing when I was a student, and I'd never heard that quote before, but it's brilliant.
Yes, it's just straight from
his person. James doesn't just know a heck of a lot about Samuel Beckett. He also discovered and popularised the Toblerone.
Thank you.
That is true.
Thank you. That's absolutely
what
correct.
Is the Toblerone for any listeners who are not familiar with
it? Well, I mean, obviously, I'm just telling them what they already know. When it is a large Toblerone with Terry's chocolate orange segments slotted perfectly, as was pre-Brexit, they slotted perfectly in between the gaps, and I tweeted this.
And it became a phenomenon. It made news around the world. And that's not an exaggeration. That's the state of the news.
Quite aside from anything I've done professionally, it got me into Private Eye. Because the Toblerone...
Defoe would have been very pleased.
The manufacturers of Toblerone entered themselves into an advertising competition because of what I did with the Toblerone, which is remarkable.
And you're now rich.
Do you know, they did contact me and offer me a little reward for doing this, and I turned them down, much to the chagrin of everybody I know. But I stand by that punk decision.
Well done.
Yeah, admirable. However, if we're looking for a podcast sponsor...
I'll just throw you a few quid from what I earn.
All right, thank you very much.
No worries.
We're also joined today by Dr. Jo Waugh. Hello, Jo.
Hello.
Jo is a senior lecturer in 19th century literature at York St. John University. Is it St. John or is it St. John?
It is St. John. I remember I went to a conference a few years ago and I knew I was with my people because instead of being asked how my surname is pronounced, the chair of the panel said... Is it St. John or St. John? And I was like, that is the right question to ask.
It used to be, I think, a theological college.
Yes, it did,
So it was St. John's Theological College at York.
Yeah.
Jo directs a module there called Sick Novels, Literature and Disease. I'm about to read a sentence which I think is the greatest bit of autobiography we've ever featured on this podcast, and that's not hype. She directs a module there called Sick Novels, Literature and Disease, on which student this year read Daniel Defoe's The Journal of the Plague Year. She's interested in contagion narratives generally and has written about rabies in Charlotte Bronte's Shirley.
Yeah,
that rivals the inventor of the Toblerone.
It's brilliant.
For a bit of bio. How many words have you written about rabies in Charlotte Bronte's Shirley?
How many words? I guess it must be about 8,000. There's a lot to say about rabies in Charlotte Bronte Shirley.
Did you have to
genuinely?
I'm sure there is. I'm going to ask you about some of the other books that you teach on this module, mm-hmm. some of the other books that you've written about, because I've found that this is just totally fascinating. And also, John and I are so excited to have a bona fide expert here to talk about, you know, elements of not just literature. Literature we've got covered. Disease we don't quite so often have covered. So
there'll be like proper doctors listening to this.
You're a doctor.
It's a fabulous Venn diagram, though, isn't it? Literature and disease. I think we're just very, very pleased to have you here.
And Joe also co-hosts a podcast, Smith and War Talk About Satire, in which she and Dr. Adam Smith discuss the history, form, function and future of satire. And when I go and listen to that, what platforms is it available on for me to listen to?
Right, if you Google satire, deaths, births and legacies, you will get to our blog and links to our podcast.
James and Joe are here to talk to us today about A Journal of the Plague Year by Daniel Defoe. First published in 1722, 3 years after his most famous novel, Robinson Crusoe.
And we should say that you are listening to this, if you've downloaded it the day or the first few days we put it out, you are listening to this 300 years to the week that Robinson Crusoe was published.
Amazing. Still in print. But the book itself, Journal of the Plague Year, is set obviously in 1665, the year of the Great Plague. But before we sink into the metropolitan miasma, Andy, what have you been reading?
Before I tell you what I've been reading, we need to just mention, if you are in either Guernsey or, or London listening to this, we have a couple of live podcast recordings coming up. We are at the Guernsey Literary Festival on Sunday, May the 5th, where we will be talking to the actor, writer and comedian Will Smith about the book of Ebenezer Lepage by G.B. Edwards, which is the most famous novel to ever come out of the Channel Islands. There you go. A novel much loved by people like William Golding and John Fowles.
And we'll have tickets for that are available.
They're through the Guernsey Literary Festival website. You can buy tickets for that. That's on Sunday, May the 5th. And then on Friday, May the 17th, we will be at Second Home in Spitalfields.
The first Unbound Literary Festival in collaboration with Second Home.
We will be talking about Beloved by Toni Morrison with Pretty Tanasia and Paddy Butler.
And Paddy Butler, who runs the bookshop Libreria. Come and see us.
And where? And tickets?
Tickets are available from the Unbound website. They're also available on the backlisted.fm. We'll have a link on that as well.
And so that is Friday, May the 17th at 7 p.m. And I'm absolutely thrilled that we're doing Beloved by Toni Morrison because, although there are the other great, lesser-known Toni Morrison novels, Beloved is, let's be honest, one of the masterpieces of the late 20th century. So slightly feeling the pressure to be to be able to communicate meaningfully about it, but it's such a fantastic book.
And we don't shy away from doing good books, as you know.
No. So right. What have I been reading?
What have you been reading?
I've been reading a novel by a writer that we featured before on Backlisted, whose name is Jane Garden. We did an episode a couple of years ago about A Long Way from Verona, which was her first book, which I really, really loved. And I've been reading through Jane Garden's backlist in the last few years. I've probably read about half a dozen of her books now. I really love her writing, and I'm totally open about saying I probably wouldn't have read her were it not for Backlisted. But the book of hers I've been reading is called Crusoe's Daughter. This was published in 1985. And I confess that I read it because I knew we were going to be doing Daniel Defoe on this episode. And I thought, oh, well, that would be nice. And read a Jane Garden, maybe talk about it. But I was totally blown away by it. I felt the only sadness I felt while reading it is that we'd already done Jane Garden and that we couldn't probably do Jane Garden again. And I think Crusoe's Daughter is within, of the novels of hers that I've read, short stories of hers that I've read, is the most fascinatingly literary, expressly literary. One of the ideas of the novel, incredibly ambitious, is to feed into the history of the development of the novel from Robinson Crusoe through to the present day, or at least the mid-1980s. Joe, you've read this, haven't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, I love this. The main character and narrator, Polly Flint, reads Robinson Crusoe obsessively and kind of almost to a point that becomes really quite problematic for her at some stages in her life. And I think I've maybe not quite as obsessively as her, but I've probably read this book almost as regularly as Polly Flint's read Robinson Crusoe. And I don't know if Jane Gardam is kind of where she comes down on Daniel Defoe. Is she saying this is a dangerous obsession, or
she absolutely loves Crusoe? She's got on the record as saying it's her favourite novel.
One of the things I love about this book is it seems to be quite a simple story about a girl who is orphaned, who grows up surrounded by women from about 1900 through to 1985. But she lives her life and is at her most alive via reading and books, which is, of course, a very backlisted idea. And one of the things that Jane Gardam does so brilliantly is create a kind of backdrop of characters who represent different literary trends. And that sounds terrible. That could be awful. But it's a mark of what a brilliant writer she is and what a great storyteller she is, that it never creaks. It feels totally natural. And here is an example of that. So the heroine, who is a young girl called Polly Flint, whose name, incidentally, Polly, like the parrot on Long John Silver's shoulder. So she's staying in a country house with a character called Lady Celia, who is clearly based on Lady Ottoline Morell, who was a patron of the literary arts. And they are having a conversation about what constitutes great literature. Maitland, she said, shall we have Polly read us some Tennyson? Yes, m'lady. Some Tennyson, Polly. An edition was produced. I read them, Tennyson. Maud. I went on for about half an hour. Then Maitland started clanking the water jug. Lady Celia had shut her eyes. The Lady of Shalott, she said. So I started that. She left the web. She left the loom. She made three paces. Lady Celia said, stop! And took a little greyish glass bottle and sniffed at it. The end, she said. So I read the end. The lovely man looking down over the bridge on the poor dead face. All of her so lovely and never even been for a walk. She must have had an awfully pasty complexion when you come to think about it. Wonderful, said Lady Celia. Is it not? I said that it was wonderful. Do you love Tennyson? Oh, yes. She lifted a necklace out of the Persian box. Better than anybody. I watched the necklace. It swung. It was seed pearls, like a little diamond clasp, like a diamond daisy. It was small, made for a girl. But I had to say, no, not better. And the necklace swung. Not best of all? Well, I don't think he's quite as good as Daniel Defoe. Daniel Defoe? She said, as if other Daniels might have got by. The one in the lion's den, or the one George Eliot wrote about, or Daniel the upright and discerning judge. Daniel Defoe? You mean Robinson Crusoe? Moll Flanders? Yes. But my child, no trace, no trace of poetry, no trace of poetic truth. But then I grew terribly angry and said in a fury, Robinson Crusoe is full of poetic truth, and it is an attempt at a universal truth very differently expressed. No form, she cried. No form. I said, it is wonderfully written. It is true to his chosen form. Because of this verisimilitude, it reads like reality. I have read it 23 times. In a novel, form is not always apparent at a first or second reading. Form is determined by hard, secret work in a notebook and in the subconscious and in the head. You speak of journalism, she said. Yes, why not, I replied, with glory added. That's brilliant. And the thing about that book is that, and about that conversation about Defoe, we'll come on to this, but there is a British intellectual tradition of looking down on Defoe as being a mere journalist, a mere hack. And one of the things we're going to talk about, I think, is how, in fact, he transcends that. John, what have you been reading this week?
I have been reading a second novel by Tishani Doshi. Her first book, The Pleasure Seekers, got tremendous reviews. She's better known, I think, as a here as a poet and a dancer than as a novelist. But this is wonderful. It's called Small Days and Nights. The title comes from a line of James Salter's in A Sport and a Pastime, a book that we did on the podcast year before last. It's in the little towns that one discovers a country in the kind of knowledge that comes from small days and nights, is the line. So the book is first-person narrative. The narrator is Grace. She's half Indian, half Italian. She has left her husband, who's an American, and she's gone back to India, to Madras, and has moved out to a small town on the coast of Tamil Nadu, where she is living with her sister, who she has discovered. She's gone back to bury her mother, and she's rediscovered the family secret, her sister who has Down syndrome. She's taken her sister, they're living alone with a woman from the village who comes and helps look after them, and a load of wild dogs that they look after. So they've created a kind of feminist utopia on the coast of... It's being encroached, of course, like all utopias, by developers wanting to buy the land. And I guess the book is best thought of as a meditation on being between two cultures. It reminded me in some ways, a very different style of book to Preeti Taneja's We That Are Young, about someone returning to India and into Indian culture and trying to find a place there. But it's beautifully, beautifully written. The relationship between Grace and her sister is wonderfully done. Exploring, I suppose, as I say, the movement between cultures of somebody who doesn't feel quite at home. And also about a woman, I'll read you a little bit, about a woman who's decided that she doesn't need to live with men to validate her existence. She manages to do that thing which is difficult. Grace isn't an entirely likable character, but the quality of the language means that you never lose sympathy with her, even when there are times when you might be frustrated with her. It's a lovely book. I'll just read it. This is from towards the end of the book, and she's in Madras talking to two of her friends, her Indian friends, and she's remembering her time in America. I had this maths professor in Charlotte, Dr. Shah. He used to invite all the Indian students to his house for a meal once a semester. There were only ever five or six of us, and we'd sit around his kitchen table, eating pakoras and roti and dal and sabji. He had young children, but he seemed so old then. One summer, his wife had taken the kids back to India. The food wasn't as good. I said to him, Dr. Shah, you must be glad to have the house to yourself. He was a sweet man, really. He said, you know, once you have kids, you'll understand. There's never any peace. When they're there, when they're not there. Men are always telling me what I don't understand because I don't have kids. I think he may have been right, though. The house isn't the same without her. It's as though I'm either too big for it or too small. It seems no sense to be living out there with the sea and those trees, all those pretty china plates in the crockery cupboard. For what? It's like some fight against obscurity, Samir says. The whole thing. Everything we do, we try to fill it with purpose. We try to find tasks. For some people, it's their kids. For others, their jobs, their art, whatever. Why worry? It's impossible not to think of time passing, even in the city. We're all of the age where we turn our hands over repeatedly, examine our faces in mirrors, watch the past recede. We sit on the balcony listening to Lou Reed. We have not said anything of survival. For most people, the point is to live.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Better. Also, I love that detail about sitting listening to Lou Reed. I was thinking, what Lou Reed? They're listening to Sally Can't Dance. Yeah. I don't think they are. They're listening to Metal Machine Music. I don't think they are.
Hey, it can't all be book chat. Smoke Chesterfields.
Bring out your dead! Bring out your dead! Bring out your dead! Bring out your dead! Bring out your dead!
So, well, everybody knows what that is, don't they? We're talking about Journal of the Plague Year by Daniel Defoe. And I'm going to cut straight to it and read the blurb on the back of this excellent American Signet Classic Edition from the 60s or 70s. It looks like, John.
Yeah.
And it starts, sure enough, with the words, bring out your dead. Bring out your dead. The ceaseless chant of doom echoed through a city of emptied streets and filled grave pits. For this was London in the year. It's hard not to make this sound like Python now. Now coming off the back of that. For this was London in
how
the
do
year.
You know he's not the king.
This was London in the year 1665, the year of the Great Plague. In 1721, when the Black Death again threatened the European continent, Daniel Defoe wrote a journal of the plague year to alert an indifferent populace to the horror that was almost upon them. Through the eyes of a saddler who had chosen to remain while multitudes fled, the master realist vividly depicted a plague-stricken city. He reenacted the terror of a helpless people caught in a tragedy they could not comprehend, the weak preying on the dying, the strong administering to the sick, the sinful orgies of the cynical, the quiet faith of the pious. With dramatic insight, he captured for all time the death throes of a great city. Now, that's terrific. I started reading that with my tongue in my cheek. I shouldn't have done that. It's really good.
It's a brilliant blurb, I think. And it sort of captures the... It captures two things, doesn't it? It captures the excitement of the story, but also the excitement that you have. It's that nobody had really done anything like this with the English language before. I mean, it's... And that kind of narrative nonfiction, or is it?
Indeed. Discuss. Well, we'll come on to that. Yes. So, James, how did we come to be doing this on Backlisted?
Well, this book has stayed with me throughout 20, 25 years of... it's interesting, we have Jo here, who's teaching The Journal of the Plague Year on her university course, because I first encountered it at university and I read it, but it may give you an insight into your students that I read it because there was going to be lots of gratuitous plague references and it was going to be all grim.
Plenty of bubos.
See, you need to know about me. I'm Beckett, but I'm also Tobe Lorange, you know. I was drawn to this by the low art of it.
Okay.
But it stays with you. And I think I ended reading it thinking, I don't know what I've just read. I don't know, did that really happen? Is it right? Okay, is it a journal? Is it a real journal? I mean, clearly it's written by, it's supposed to be written by HF, who is the narrator of the whole thing. So who's he? Or, is it a completely fictional account? Or it seems to be pretty straightforward journalism, effectively. And yet... It's not. So it has these many various registers in it of it's slightly gossipy, which is what I was there for. You know, it's like reading Chat magazine or something, and very gratuitous.
It's a fantastically interesting mixture of the lurid and the pedantic.
Yes, absolutely.
it's got the buboes you were looking for.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's also got this incredibly laborious, is the right word, listing of registers of the dead and bits of paper that the narrator is keen to impress upon you that he can prove what he's saying.
Yeah.
Joe, when you teach it, how do you present it to your students?
I think, first of all, you have to make it really clear that it isn't exactly, James, what you kind of said you were sort of expecting from it, that it's kind of a real-life account and also that it's somebody's first-person perspective. If you encounter this on a university syllabus, possibly that's as part of a trajectory that goes from Pepys and the Great Fire of London and so on. And then now we move on to the next chapter, which is all about the plague and Daniel Defoe writing about it. And then it is kind of surprising, isn't it, that moment when you realise or when you explain that this isn't somebody recounting their first-hand experience of the plague. And also that I think the blurb, on as hilarious as that blurb is, I think that attributes Defoe with too much kind of morality, that he's just desperately worried everyone's going to get a plague, so he's just writing about how bad a plague would be.
It's not just that.
Well, it is a bit that. But
tell
us
about, because he'll come on to Defoe, the extraordinarily fecund writer Daniel Defoe.
Yes.
He didn't write just one book about plague.
Yeah.
At a time, did he? He simultaneously wrote another book called
Due Preparations for the Plague, which is...
And that is the book that you would say he's writing that as a warning. You know, that's more of, as far as we can tell.
Yeah. I think that is more about kind of you need to prepare your soul in case the plague does come here again and it probably is going to. But Journal of the Plague Year, I think there's an element of that, but it's also... well, maybe this is just me coming at it from my interest, but I suspect he also knows that people like reading about diseases and that diseases are quite fun to write about, and epidemics have a huge set of narrative affordances and people like reading about epidemics.
Well, Journal of the Plague Year is one of over 50 texts that were published after plague broke out in Europe, in Marseille in 1720 or whenever it was, the belief that plague was coming to England. And other books were more successful than A Journal of the Plague Year. And one of the reasons for that might be for the same reason that we find it perhaps more challenging to read now than we might have expected to, which is that it's actually quite an odd book, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and he'll tell you that he's going to tell you something and then not tell you it for ages.
The three men.
There's an anecdote about three men, which I'll confess to you now, everyone, I didn't quite follow when it finally came up. But he really sets it up. It's like 50 pages earlier. He said, now, I must get to this story of the three men. But while I'm here, let me just tell you about something else quickly before I get onto that.
And that exact story, which occurs, what, three quarters of the way through the book, maybe? That, if this was a novel, is what your modern 21st century editor would be saying, right, start with those.
Yeah, start with these three guys.
It's perfect for that, but this book is not that.
Actually, their story does have to be not exactly dull, but they leave town.
You know, as you'd imagine, everywhere they go, all the small places they go aren't very keen on them. But then they find people who are quite nice to them, and they look after them and help them, and they end up going back to town again. So there isn't a massive battle or nobody dies. So,
but also what's so fascinating about any anecdote that appears in this book, and this is the thing to me that seemed incredibly sophisticated. Any anecdote that is told to you by the narrator is there to do at least two things. One is to entertain you with the anecdote, but the other is to reveal character, tell you something about the narrator of the book and why he thinks this is an anecdote worth telling you. And that seemed to me really sophisticated.
Defoe never does anything without having some political reason for doing it. He's one of the great political writers of the English language, kind of invented political journalism, I think, in a way, sort of middle-class political journalism that wasn't sort of defending the high Tory ideals. He was an investigative reporter, you know, before there was such a thing as an investigative reporter. And this book, it's a sort of seminal text, as well as the history of fiction, but it's also the history of in-depth journalism, I think.
James, could you read us a bit?
Yes, I've got this bit. It ties in a little bit with what you're saying about the not boring narrative of the three men. If you look at the narrative of what happens to the narrator, you could sum that up by saying he goes to see a plague pit and then he doesn't like it very much, and that's the end of that. So it's the narrative.
He survives, yeah.
It's the narrative you don't have, and that, I think, it maybe a narrative is what dates a book.
Yeah.
And so I've got a section which is the narrator who's wrestling with his own conscience about what he's going to go and see. He is compelled to go to see a plague pit. And he says, "It was about the 10th of September that my curiosity led, or rather drove me, to go and see this pit again, when there had been near 400 people buried in it. And I was not content to see it at daytime as I had done before, for then there would have been nothing to have seen but the loose earth, for all the bodies that were thrown in were immediately covered with earth by those they called the buriers. But I resolved to go in at the night and see some of them thrown in. There was a strict order to prevent people coming to these pits, and that was only to prevent infection. But after some time, that order was more necessary, for people that were infected and near their end, and delirious also, would run to those pits wrapped in blankets or rugs and throw themselves in. And as they said, bury themselves. I cannot say that the officers suffered any willingly to lie there, but I have heard that in a great pit in Finsbury, in the parish of Cripplegate, it lying open then to the fields, for it was not then walled about, came and threw themselves in and expired there before they threw any earth upon them. And that was when they came to bury others and found them there. They were quite dead, though not cold. This may serve a little to describe the dreadful condition of that day, though it is impossible to say anything that is able to give a true idea of it to those who did not see it, other than this, that it was indeed very, very, very dreadful, and such as no tongue can express. I got admittance into the churchyard by being acquainted with the sexton, who, though he did not refuse me at all, yet earnestly persuaded me not to go, telling me very seriously, for he was a good and religious and sensible man, that it was indeed their business and duty to venture and to run all hazards, and that in it they might hope to be preserved, but that I had no apparent call to it, but my own curiosity, which he said he believed I would not pretend was sufficient to justify my running that hazard. I told him I had been pressed in my mind to go, and that perhaps it might be an instructing sight that might not be without its uses. Nay, says the good man, if you'll venture upon that school, name of God, go in, for depend upon it, 'twill be a sermon to you. It may be the best that you ever heard in your life. 'Tis a speaking sight, says he, and has a voice with it, and a loud one, to call us all to repentance. And with that, he opened the door and said, go, if you will.
God, that is good.
And that compulsion to go.
Yeah.
But no, he's going to be shocked by what he sees. That's a very modern compulsion. Don't look behind the door. Don't go and look in there. You will be shocked. And I think at the heart of this book, one of the things I think I can see is somebody wrestling with their conscience, wrestling with God and their religion, and all of the evidence before them tells them that what they feel about God and why this pestilence is upon them, it's pointing in the other direction. It's not a godly pestilence. It's not being thrown down upon them. It's an infection. That encapsulates the wrestling nature within their souls. Yeah. They're wrestling against what they know, but what they're compelled to do and what they feel they know.
It's also reflected, I think, that, James, in the structure of the book, or the weird labyrinthine structure of the book. And also that labyrinthine nature. This is an incredible book about London. I don't just mean as a historical resource, but you see this in Defoe a lot, that just he's a product of London. And the structure of the book sort of reflects that pre-Great Fire warren of streets and courts and overhanging buildings and places. And he's always moving around.
I'm interested to know, Joe, what in terms of disease and the movement of disease, he keeps trying to overturn the myths that the streets were full of unburied dead. I mean, in some ways, the book is a bit of a snow job for the authorities. He's always saying how well run the whole thing was, and weren't we lucky that it starts 1665 in a shop in Long Acre. There's some Dutch cloth that's unwrapped, and that's the first case of plague. And it moves gradually, quite slowly, through the city and gathers kind of momentum until in September there's like 10,000 people dying a week. And he's continually trying to work out what's true and what isn't. Were the authorities overwhelmed? Were corpses left unburied, which he thinks they weren't? So at the same time, he's telling these compelling bits of narrative. At the same time, he's acting like a sort of a modern kind of investigative journalist, saying, well, hang on, are these claims substantiated? Did it? Just as a record of a disease, it's very different from Pepys, isn't it?
Yes, and he quite often does that, doesn't he? He'll say, like, well, lots of people were saying this at the time and lots of people were saying that. And for myself, I incline to the view that it was something different. And that's all part of establishing realism, isn't it? That he'll say, well, you know, there was this thing and there was that thing. Yeah. And I'm not sure which one had the most veracity to it. And also, I suppose, the way that the narrative works and the way that we don't know what's going to turn out to be consequential and what isn't, what's going to be important, what story is going to get followed up, is also kind of like the disease itself. And he talks about people who you don't know that they're healthy, you don't know that they're carrying the plague, you don't know if they might be massively infectious but look perfectly healthy. And the way that it moves through the streets, as the narrative moves through the streets, it is a kind of disease path, isn't
it? Yeah. I don't know if in your portfolio of disease narratives, you have covered the 1970s BBC TV series Secret Army.
I haven't, no.
Okay, so Secret Army, you have to be a certain age to remember this series, but this was very, very popular in the 1970s and has fallen out of public recognition, partly because it's the series on which the comedy series Allo, Allo was based. Set during the Second World War, the Belgian resistance fighting the occupying forces, the Germans. It's a magnificent series, and they made three seasons of it, the third of which contains an episode called Ring of Roses. And every episode of Secret Army was based on things that actually happened during the Second World War. And in Belgium in the Second World War, a pilot was brought down who had been in Africa and had contracted bubonic plague in 1944. Wow. And had to be quarantined in just the way that houses have to be quarantined in Journal of the Plague year. So we've got a clip here from the episode Ring of Roses. And what you're listening to is Monique, who is the head of the Belgian resistance, locked up with a series of coughing airmen. And they are about a week into their confinement.
I feel so dirty. If I ever get out of this place, I'm going to scrub myself till I'm raw. Wash 20 times a day. I've not been much help to you, have I? I'm no good around sickness, never have been.
Not everybody is, my dear. Unfortunately, there's another new case.
Who is it?
Me.
You can't be sick.
Doctors are not immune, my dear. That's a myth fostered by the American cinema. Oh, yes, I've got a bulbar in my groin and... oh, all the other symptoms are coming up like in a textbook. I never thought I'd see plague, let alone experience it at first hand.
God help us now.
Besides, there's something else.
No, there can't be anything else, Pascal.
The idea of plague is so unlikely that should it ever get outside, one side or the other is fully capable of convincing itself that the epidemic was no accident.
You mean that either the Allies or the Germans would think it was the result of deliberate germ warfare?
Yes, and that's why no one must leave this place unless they are without infection.
Well, what do I do with the ones who've died?
Burn them. Clothing, everything. Everything must be destroyed.
Now, I saw that episode in 1979 at the age of 11. Joe, we were just saying that the issues that they're talking about there, about quarantine and burning and those are exactly what happens in Daniel Defoe's book.
Yeah, and often in this narrative that he will often kind of talk about sometimes what seems to be a kind of trumped up fear about the sick, that they have a kind of malign determination to infect the healthy, that if you let them out, they will run around and infect people in quite sort of upsetting ways. But there is, as much as sometimes this sympathy for people who are locked up with the sick and who are therefore utterly damned because they will definitely get the plague and they're imprisoned unto death with the sick. So there's a couple of points actually where Defoe compares the sick to mad dogs, as if they're kind of rabid, running around London and actively wanting to infect people. And he twice describes them as mad dogs. And he talks about how it's cruel to shut people up and it's cruel to quarantine them, but also you kind of have to. Yeah. So there's a fairly brief passage here, which is one of the ones where he describes them as mad dogs. But he says, "It is most certain that if by the shutting up of houses the sick had not been confined, multitudes who in the height of their fever were delirious and distracted would have been continually running up and down the streets, and even as it was a very great number did so, and offered all sorts of violence to those they met, even just as a mad dog runs on and bites at everyone he meets. Nor can I doubt but that should one of those infected, diseased creatures have bitten any man or woman while the frenzy of the distemper was upon them, they, I mean the person so wounded, would as certainly have been incurably infected as one that was sick before and had the tokens upon him." So it's really interesting that his assumption is that if you weren't shut up, if you weren't quarantined, you would just go out and run up and down the streets and bite people. And he relates later a kind of an anecdote that's more disturbing than that about the man who allegedly goes and kind of well, Defoe says kisses, but I think we understand it's more than that, and then says, well, if I've got the plague, why shouldn't you?
Chases a woman and falls over and sort of kick you. It's a really sinister scene.
Yeah. But that idea of a kind of proto-zombie narrative, right? The idea of they're ill, but what the illness renders them aggressive and brainless, so that all they want to do is eat other people's brains. That's really here in what you've been saying.
Yeah, and the whole kind of the deserted streets of London, nobody was walking up this street and nobody was walking down there and the businesses were closed. It is, I don't know if it's so much that this is a precursor of the zombie narrative or that zombie narratives implicitly, unconsciously draw on plague narratives and contagion narratives, but the two have a lot in common.
Mm. Yes, well, there's a bit where he says that the plague at last came to such violence that the people sat still looking at one another and seemed quite abandoned to despair. Whole streets seemed to be desolated and not to be shut up only, but to be emptied of their inhabitants. Doors were left open, windows stood, shattering with the wind in empty houses for want of people to shut them.
Mm.
James Joyce loved Journal of the Plague, and he said the prose was masterful and orchestral. He took it as a novel. He thinks it's a kind of a great novel.
You know, Journal of the Plague Year was not recognised as the work of Daniel Defoe until 1750.
Interesting.
And that is typical of the quantity of work that he produced, that even now there is debate about how many publications he made. The minimum is 250. The maximum is 550.
Yeah, they've got
people still argue about
DNB goes for mid table. The Dictionary National Biography so 318 attested works, but there is no standard edition of his collected works, and less than a quarter of the books that we know he has written are not in print.
Well, I found a piece in the TLS from the 1950s by Julian McLaren Ross, otherwise known in fictional terms as X-Trapnel from A Dance to the Music of Time. And this is from a review of a 1950s republication of A Journal of the Plague Year. And this will allow us to say a little bit about Daniel Defoe. What is it about Defoe's writing that spoke to people then and placed him apart from other writers and still speaks to us now? And this is what Julian McLaren Ross wrote. He's speaking about Robinson Crusoe, which was a huge success when it was published 300 years ago. So much of a success that, in fact, he wrote a sequel the same year and then another sequel the following year. And Julian McLaren Ross says, Crusoe was looked down upon by the litterateur of the time, Swift, who displaced Defoe in Harley's favour, dismissed the author as, quote, an illiterate fellow whose name I forget. And though Pope did in fact praise the first part of the book, its appeal was primarily supposed to be to kitchen maids and serving men. An error of judgment which should be remembered when we attempted to assess some contemporary work by purely highbrow standards. Whether any parallel in fact exists between Defoe's life and the adventures of the shipwrecked mariner on his desert island is extremely dubious. Brackets, the misfortunes of the author might be said, allowing for the difference in sex, more closely to resemble those of Moll Flanders, close brackets. But the value of the book as literature is unquestionable, and the opinion of the public, which devoured it voraciously, in spite of the disapproval of literary cliques in 1719 and successive years, has been triumphantly vindicated. Defoe had not only a keen eye for popular taste, sharpened by financial necessity, something that Julian McLaren Ross knew all about, everybody, since changing political trends and the deliberate meanness of his employers kept him in almost permanent need of ready cash, he had also an unerring instinct, and this is the thing, amounting to genius for the universal situation. The sailor building with his slender resources a new life upon the lonely shore. The Londoners immured in the plague-ridden city. The juvenile delinquent, the thief, the soldier of fortune, the woman living by her wits. This instinct was his main strength, and to back it, he brought his simple, graphic, colloquial style. Now, that, I think, is a brilliant appraisal of what is unique about Defoe. And James, I was thinking, I mean, just in the section that you were reading earlier, it was very, very, very dreadful. A more self-regarding writer would not have used that phrase. But he wants to sell the colloquial thought of the narrator.
Yeah. One of the things that really strikes me about this book, now, I don't know if I've got this right, but the Pepys diaries were not known at this time. Is that correct? Because they weren't...
Yes.
They were written in code.
They had not translated for several years.
And the one small delightful fact I learned about Pepys diaries being decrypted was that the person who was doing the decrypting only found out that on the shelf above Pepys's diaries was a key to the decrypting, and he got almost all the way through and then found out that he could have just looked at this key. But the fact is, as far as I know, Defoe would not have known about Pepys's diaries, and yet it's intriguing to me that the work happened anyway. Defoe knew that a journal, or even a collection of Plague's greatest hits, you know, needed to be there. For what reason? I don't know. Was he specific about his reasons why he produced this piece of work? Was it a warning? Was it an entertainment? Was it, you know, Chat magazine? I don't know, but it needed to be there. And it seems like he was very sensitive to that fact. The first writer I thought of when I was rereading this recently was George Orwell, because he's like very sensitive to the needs of what people need to know about the everyday life that's going on around them, and just jotting down the realities of living when you are poor or when you are needy. You know, this is Robinson Crusoe in the urban world, isn't it, effectively?
And he also has, there's a fantastic essay by Virginia Woolf about Robinson Crusoe, which it starts with her saying, I am writing this in the week that Robinson Crusoe was published 200 years ago. So it's like she wrote these words 100 years ago about now. But she concludes with a fantastic phrase, chiming in, James, with what you were just saying there. With Defoe, she says, we are forced to drop our own preconceptions to the subject and accept what Defoe himself wishes to give us. We were a bit mean about Virginia Woolf's critical faculties on the previous episode of Backlist in relation to Dickens, but that seems to me spot on.
Yeah.
But he'll use whatever method he can to tell you what he wants you to know, right? Mm. So when he wants narrative, he resorts to narrative. But at other times, he feels he doesn't need it. He can go off and talk about something else, but he'll get you.
Yeah.
Language he might use, or he might use scripture. And I love in this book and in Robinson Crusoe and in... We haven't even talked about Moll Flanders. Yeah. What an incredible book that is. I'd never read that before last week. Incredible book. That magnificent feeling of somebody making it up as they go along in the best possible way. Coasting on genius is the phrase. They know they've got talent. They know that they can write in this vivid, grabbing way, and they say, okay, here we go. Buckle yourself in because we're off.
But you sort of know what he's doing with Moll. I mean, I'm interested, Joe, what do you think he's doing with this book? What's compelling him to write this, other than that, you know, the Donne is good, isn't it? A Plague is a good, it's a great story.
That's really difficult, is it? Because I think there is a sense that, you know, we need to be thinking about the plague and we need to be thinking how awful it would be if it came back again. But I wonder if there's a kind of a pleasure in pulling off that coup, because this is found footage, right? This is HF's diary, and, you know, there's that wonderful little reminder really near the end when he's talking about all the places that were given over to store the dead, and then it's like square brackets, by the way, the author of this journal is buried here. FYI, I'm dead. But and that's kind of really striking.
But not of the plague, we don't think.
Yeah. Well done, you. Yeah. But I do think there's a kind of... perhaps an element of joy and pleasure in pulling this off, that this is found footage, this is a genuine journal of the plague year, and that it, you know, as you were saying, people don't work it out for really quite a long time.
Mm.
Also that disease is an inherently fascinating thing to read about and write about, and there's a market for it. And, you know, Defoe is not immune to the need to make money and to have a readership. There's those two things. There's the element of warning as well. And I suppose I just like to feel that it's something about mastering the subject and mastering the reader. And I think to an extent that also kind of explains or accounts for the mishmash of, you know, here's a table of facts and figures, and then here's an anecdote which may or may not be true, and I personally think it probably isn't true, and here's some things that I think, and then some serious moralising as well about the charlatans and the astrologers.
That made me very suspicious at times, because there's a story he tells about the piper who gets thrown into the pit. Now, that story,
that's pure Monty Python, isn't it?
According to Dr. Watson Nicholson in his 1919 book, The Historical Sources of Defoe's Journal of the Plague Year, he says, "Well, that story dates from 50 years before. That was first told then." So he's compiling a lot of stories. But the thing I find fascinating about this is, what does it take to get people to remember something? And I'm going to throw in a biggie at this stage, right? We are the generation who remembers about, or have been told about, the Holocaust. What was prior to the Holocaust that was the big bad thing? And, you know, I really don't know. I'm not bringing knowledge to this, but surely the plague was one of those things that the whole of society has to remember for longer than a generation.
Yeah.
And how do you host that information across the generations, even about the Holocaust, for example, which has become a tremendous hot potato as to how is it remembered and so on. I don't need to go into that. But it's being remembered is absolutely vital. And it seems to me, if it takes you doing The Best of the Plague and putting it into a single volume that people can read,
With some actual evidence, I've gathered my sources. I'm not just making this stuff up.
So that seems to me a terrific reason to be doing it. Now, was that his reason to do it?
I don't know, because I mean, that's making me think about the whole HF persona and that those were his uncle's initials. Mm. And was he pretending to be that Henry Foe, or is HF just a coincidence? And I suppose if you were generous, then you could say that Defoe, a small child when the plague broke out, probably sent out of London, missed all of everything, perhaps found something compelling about inhabiting the voice he thought that his uncle might have used to talk about the plague, or that gave him some kind of legitimacy to talk about the plague. Yeah. Or, of course, it could be completely coincidental, and there's 26 letters in an alphabet, and he chose H and F.
We should say a little bit about Daniel Defoe. Part of the pleasure of doing this episode has just been reading about Daniel Defoe frequently slack-jawed in disbelief.
He's got to be the best English writer's life ever.
So he doesn't, write these famous books we're talking about till he's in his 60s.
No, he's 62 when he writes.
So he's already lived a life in which he has been variously a bankrupt to the tune of £17,000,
which is a
lot of money.
Yeah, getting on for £1 million.
He's been a spy. He's been a pamphleteer.
He invents with the Review in 1702, really the kind of modern political journalism.
He is put in the stocks. He is pilloried.
Pilloried three times.
And he makes that work for him by writing a pamphlet called A Hymn to the Pillory. So he's in the stocks. He recites Hymn to the Pillory and all the peasants go, "This guy's terrific." And it becomes a mini bestseller. And then
he fought at the Battle of Sedgemoor because he was in Monmouth's Rebellion.
Amazing.
So, I mean,
he helps invent the English novel. We can debate, and people will always debate, the extent to which these books are the first English novels.
He's definitely,
but
reaching,
they contribute.
He's reaching those.
He is thought of as the author of the first modern ghost story, The Apparition of Mrs. Veal, which was published as a pamphlet anonymously in 1706. If you went to a bookshop, you would still find his work in about half a dozen different sections.
He was a staggeringly unsuccessful entrepreneur. You know, when he wasn't writing, he was. I just love this. He expanded out of his core business, which was hosiery. into trying to get into the difficult overseas markets. He was crazed. He was a madman for trade. And in fact, his writing on trade, the importance of trade to the English, it actually occurs in the narrative here, because there's a brilliant bit where he says, none of the Europeans will deal with us. So he bought tobacco from Maryland, lost out, sold wine and beer to Belfast, lost out. And then he actually invests in a diving bell to rescue sunken treasures. And then he gets onto the perfume of the civet cat that's imported from the Far East, makes no money on that, and then, of course, goes bankrupt. And he, even though he makes quite a lot of money out of his writing, he gambles it and loses it and ends up in a terrible, dying ridiculously of lethargy in sort of more or less in debtor's prison, lethargy being a stroke, they think, rather than not doing anything.
James, we're always talking about how we feel about plot on this podcast. I'm against it, as you know. As a novelist, when you read this, do you feel get on with it? Do you feel I'm in the hands of somebody who knows what they're doing?
This book is, it's so vexed. It really makes you come and find it and fill it and see what's going on. And so in that sense, it draws you in through something other than plot. This is not a plotted book, is it? This would not be published now with any great deal of success. You know, like all classics, it would not be picked up now. And I think that
Defoe would be an absolute shoo-in for crowdfunding. He'd absolutely love it.
I think they'd just tell him, like,
it's a genre buster.
You know that bit where that man attacks that woman in the street? Just do that.
But what's brilliant, I mean, I did bring some slightly modern eyes to this because I was reading it, and he starts off entirely generally, and he doesn't even say I until I think page 8 or 10 or something like that. He doesn't introduce the narrator until later on. So the whole tone of the book is about a general public, and I don't know any other books. That's a side project of mine. How many books have the public as a character effectively? And you know, that's what made me think of Orwell a little. So
Well, I think he's like Orwell because he is, like I say, you feel that he is just, he's interested in politics and power and power relationships, and he's interested in what these things mean. He's always sort of looking to get meaning from the plague. I was going to ask you, Joe, this is the last major plague, isn't it, that this 1665, it's the last big one.
Yeah, pretty much.
And does it haunt literature, I mean, other than Defoe? Does it come up much in other stuff in there?
This plague?
Or just plague as a sort of the...
Well, it's really interesting. When I read Plague Year through the lens of thinking about typhus epidemics in 1847, a lot of the stuff is really, really similar. The stigma around who's got it, and that whole bit where Defoe talks about how afterwards all the doctors who'd run away and hadn't treated anyone their names were mud, and nobody
doctors
would
and the
have
priests
to do
were given
with
a really, really hard time, weren't they?
Yeah.
Cowards.
Yeah. I suppose what I would lean towards thinking that the narratives that surrounded the plague and the anxieties that surrounded the plague in the 17th century might well have been lurking anxieties and lurking narratives as at other points in the 19th century, where people were encountering typhus and cholera, the big scary cholera epidemics that were never on the level of the plague, that were never as universal as this plague. But those same kind of anxieties and stigmas and ways of thinking about quarantine and containment, at some level, I think are kind of lurking in the ways that people are thinking about disease as and when it crops up again. And cholera is terrifying and horrifying and a really serious fear at several points in the 19th century. It's never, ever anything like this bad. But I think the fact that we had at one point had this plague that virtually wiped out London must have been there in the ways that people responded to those diseases.
There's also parallels, aren't there, with the idea of plagues rather than bubonic plague, but diseases as plague, coming out of the unknown, coming out of the darkness, the idea that when Defoe's writing about the Black Death, the idea that it's come out from somewhere unknown in Europe.
Yeah.
modern examples, you know, the idea that AIDS might have come out of Africa, the Asian bird flu. People want to give it a personality. That's the thing that comes out in this book. But the idea of plague as being
foreign,
unknowable. Yeah, it reminded me of the Grok in the Moomin books. This dark thing that freezes the ground. She crosses,
and maybe that you're going back to your Holocaust point. He resists that largely, doesn't he? He says that there's a brilliant bit where he says, "But the case was this, and I shall only touch it here, namely that the infection was propagated insensibly, and by such persons who were not visibly infected, who neither knew whom they infected or who they were infected by." So, just saying, it wasn't people actually actively going out there and behaving badly. It's just how diseases like this work.
Yeah, and I think if anything, he resists exactly what you were talking about, that tendency to characterise disease as foreign, as coming to our shores from elsewhere, and hence being a way to think about immigration.
He was the kind of the sword against the Farages of his day. Amazing. I'm afraid we've come to the end of our great tribulation. The distemper has been held at bay, and we must extend our sincere thanks to James and Joe, to our all angel of deliverance, Alana Chance, and to our most highly esteemed patron, Milord Unbound.
If you're a backlisted premium member, keep listening. We're going to do an hour on Mole Flanders now. but for those of you who get this for free, you can download all 90 of our shows, plus follow links, clips, and suggestions for further reading by visiting our website at backlisted.fm, and you can contact us on Twitter, Facebook, and via Boundless. And before you do that, you can leave us a review on iTunes. Think of it as a bulwark against pestilential sounds.
Thank you for your company. If you prefer to listen to Backlisted without adverts, you can sign up to our Patreon. It's www.patreon.com/backlisted. As well as getting the show early, you get a whole two extra episodes of what we call Locklisted, which is Andy, me and Nikki talking about the books, music and films we've enjoyed in the previous fortnight.